You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 100 by Rudolf Steiner. The book itself is entitled True Knowledge of the Christ, composed of two lecture cycles. We are on the first one entitled Theosophy and Rosicrucianism, 14 lectures translated by Anna Mois. This is lecture 11, given in Kassel on the 26th of June, 1907. Yesterday we reached the point in considering the evolution of the different states of our earth, where we saw how the united three cosmic bodies, sun, moon, and earth, separated off one after the other. On the one hand, we started from there and stopped at the point where the moon separated from the earth. On the other hand, we also sought to reach that point by starting from the present and going back through Atlantis to this same point. Let us be clear in our minds what the state of the earth itself was then. You have to think of long, long periods of time, millions of years. And then it will also not be so surprising how great the changes were in the universe and also on earth. Let us now take a closer look at the separate earth. It was still enveloped in a mass of air, though this looked very different from our present-day atmosphere. You should not think that this air was something like the inside of a red-hot oven, although the temperature was much higher than today. Many substances that are solid today were then liquid in the earth. An air densely packed with the vapors of all kinds of substances enveloped the earth, something we might perhaps call fire air, a recapitulation of the former moon state. When the earth had grown independent following the departure of the present moon, it was surrounded by a strange atmosphere which we might call fire air. Because the earth had become free of the atmosphere that had gone away with the moon, the life forms were capable of gaining certain higher levels. Within this atmosphere, the most advanced animal humans had reached a higher level than the one they had had on the moon, capital. But only those which later became human beings. A large number of these animal human beings stayed at the moon level. The result was that they did not just stay where they were, but under the completely new conditions which pertained, animal human beings could exist only on the moon, went down by half a level and became animals which had not existed on the moon. So we have two realms, human beings and the world of animal human beings, which remained behind and gradually went down to animal level. It was the same with the plant animals. A number of them had developed further into animals. Others stayed put and became plants. And the plant mineral world divided itself up so that some became heavy minerals and others developed into plants. Things did not develop according to one single standard. The animals we have today have partly evolved down from human animals and partly up from plant animals. In the same way, the plant world consists of plant minerals that have moved up to be plants and plant animals that have moved down. The plants, which today are mainly making up our aesthetic plant cover, are plant minerals from the moon that have moved up, the violet, for example. But everything that strikes us as musty has evolved downward, whereas our green herbaceous plants will move to higher levels in the future. Our minerals have altogether evolved on Earth. Nothing mineral as we know it today existed on the old moon. This is the plant mineral world, which has gone down, forming a solid crust in the earth. When the earth cast out the moon, everything which remained to be mineral, solid metal, and so on, later on was still altogether in the liquid state. Anything that had turned solid was flung out into cosmic space. For if the earth had retained these substances, there would have been no further development. Then inclusions arose of the metals, which were the earliest to grow solid. Some had strange forms. The granite, the gneiss in our mountains today, did at that time still clearly show its origin in plant forms that developed down, turning to stone. Essentially, you may take it that on old sun and old moon, the whole mineral world had still been plant world. The plant world did not evolve from the mineral world, but the minerals from the plant world. The anthracite you dig up today is but a sum of petrified plants, plants that perished, rotted down, and turned to stone, so that they may today be dug up as plants turned to stone. If you were to go still further back, you would find that even the densest stones have once been plants, only coming into existence when plants developed down into the mineral world. For the seer, things are as follows. Looking at gneiss, mineralogists will say that it consists of feldspar, hornblende, and mica. That is as far as they can go. The seer says, quote, "The feldspar in gneiss still shows itself to the spiritual eye to be the stem and green leaves that made up the plant which have grown solid, and the mica part has something to do with what does today still develop in the sepals and petals of plants." So an occultist, looking at a piece of gneiss, will say, quote, "That is petrified plant, and where today the plants have leaves and flowers and so on, the mica part comes from the old sepals and petals," close quote. We can tell how all minerals have developed from plants, for it was plants that came across from the moon, old moon, and they only condensed in the fluid earth mass. It is like having a vessel filled with water today, where the water begins to solidify to form ice. More and more inclusions formed, and gradually the solid earth crust evolved from the liquid earth. The further we go, the higher and more pure will the life forms be. Those that were unable to rise turned to stone. It was the same in the case of animals and human beings. Human beings got so far that they were able to refashion their body to a yet higher degree. The old moon human beings moved by floating and swimming in the prime ocean. They were designed to swim around like this. This may sound most peculiar to present-day people, but it is true nevertheless. Let me say unreservedly, I don't even want to make any of this sound less grotesque. People will always laugh at truths when these first show themselves. The human beings, floating in the prime ocean, did not have eyes that could see the way our eyes do today. The potential for eyes had been created on old Saturn. But down there in the prime ocean, human beings had no need to see. They had to get their bearings in other ways. The prime ocean also contained everything that they consumed in order to keep alive. Some animals in the ocean were friends, others not so friendly toward them. The prime ocean was warm in places and cold elsewhere. Human beings were able to tolerate the former, but not the latter. They still had an organ the size of a cherry stone, which today is inside the head, the pineal gland, although It is not a gland in the usual sense. At one time, this organ had been enormously developed. It was the organ they used to get their bearings in the ocean, and it projected from the head like a kind of lantern. Human beings moved around with the aid of this lantern-like structure. It was a subtly sentient organ, sensitive to temperatures, allowing them to perceive temperatures they were able to tolerate or not. This organ gave them their bearings, but did not provide vision. It served them as they swam. Later, it was no longer needed and therefore shrunk in size. At that time, one could not speak of even the potential for an I capital. Human beings depended on the guidance of higher spiritual powers in everything they did. We may roughly compare them to the animals of today. From the spiritual scientific point of view, present-day animals are seen more or less as follows. Human beings differ from animals in that they have individual souls. Every human being has an individual soul, an individual I or self. It is not like that in the case of animals. They have group souls. Thus, all animals belonging to the lion family have a soul which lives in the astral world. All animals of the tiger family have one soul in common. All horses have one group soul. They belong together. Individual animals relate to their group soul as individual fingers relate to the hand. We therefore also cannot speak of individual responsibility. We only speak of a soul being good or evil once it is an individual soul. The human beings of that time still had a kind of group soul, which was in the keeping of the Godhead. It has to be clearly understood, therefore, that the principle which lives in us did exist at that time, but it was not within the human body. Human beings have their origin in two streams. The animal-human being down below had come across from the old moon and developed further. But the individual soul, which lives in you today, was then up above with the Godhead. Only your body was down below in the prime ocean. The two came together later on when the soul descended and inspirited your living body as an individual soul. Think of a vessel filled with water. It contains many, many drops of water, but one cannot tell them apart. If you now put in hundreds of tiny sponges, the droplets that were in the body of water will become individual. This is how you think of your spirituality hovering above the prime ocean. Compare the soul, resting in the Godhead's keeping, with the drop of water. The living bodies take in the souls just as the tiny sponges take up the drops of water. Souls became independent, just as the water had been individualized in the tiny sponges. Below the prime ocean with the floating, swimming bodies and above the souls. There is no better way of describing this but to say, quote, "And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters." Close quote. It means that God developed the element which was below so that it became possible for the soul drops to be taken up. The bodies themselves had to keep afloat, and for this the entities needed an organ. At that time, human beings did not yet have a lung, but they had a kind of air bladder that kept them afloat in the prime ocean. The fishes, which have stayed at this level, still have air bladders and no lungs today. The lungs developed slowly and gradually as the air was cleared of water, and human beings were able to get above the waters and turn into air breathers. It was a long process, a process that took millions of years, with human beings gradually taking up air through lungs. This provided the physical structure which was able to take in the soul. You cannot put it better Then, quote, and God breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became an individual soul, close quote. Human beings did at the same time gain the ability to develop something which they could not have developed earlier. They were now able to develop red blood. Earlier, all human beings had been made in such a way that their temperature was the same as that of their environment. With more warmth around them, they would be adapted to that warmth. Red blood did not exist at all before that. The animals, which are above the amphibians, are human bodies that remained behind at a still later time. It was only after the time when human beings developed into creators of red blood that animals which had red blood also developed. No plant has ever evolved from a stone, but the stone developed from the plant. And in the same way, animals developed from the human being. All lower creation has evolved from the higher. That is the principle of evolution. Human beings had to become red-blooded creatures before they could leave behind the animals. In the animals, you literally see the stages spread out, which we have left behind us. Human beings more or less see a part of themselves in them, which they have left behind. Paracelsus put this beautifully, quote, looking around us, we see as it were the letters of an alphabet. It is only in man that they come together in a word. Because of this, man is the meaning of everything spread out about him. Close quote. There is one thing you must consider. A seemingly insignificant process went on at that time, which is, however, extraordinarily important for the science of the spirit. Basically, it had started when the earth first appeared, still together with the moon. It was that Mars and earth worked together in a sense. During the whole first half of earth evolution, Mars' powers flowed down onto the earth. Because of this, that first half is referred to as the earth's Mars state. Iron was connected with this passage through Mars, and from then on played a completely new role in the Earth process. With planets, the role of iron is a much more external one. But you see how things interrelate. Cosmically, the Earth passes through Mars, and Mars gives it iron. The iron was then stimulated to perform the function which it now has. Iron appeared in the blood at that time. And iron-containing blood means aggression for human beings, making them warriors on earth. In Greek mythology, Mars is therefore the god of war. The human body was then able to take in an eye, capital, for a body cannot be a vehicle for an eye unless it has warm red blood. After this, the processes needed on earth developed, getting incorporated into the blood. Human beings gradually evolved into a lung-breathing, red-blooded life form, and left the other creatures, the lower warm-blooded life forms, behind. In occult terms, animals are differentiated not only in the usual way. There is another characteristic. We differentiate them into creatures that have inner sound, those able to give expression to pain and pleasure in sounds, and those that do not produce sounds. If you move down to lower animals, you will also hear sounds, but these are merely external, produced by rubbing organs together or through external climatic influences. The sounds are produced externally. Only the animals which branched off at the time when human beings evolved into warm-blooded creatures were of a kind that could utter pain and pleasure in sounds coming from inside. It was at that time in the past when the human larynx was transformed into an organ that produces sounds. With the liquid earth outside changing into a crust, an inner process happened in human beings. parallel to the solidification outside, the soft parts inside became a skeleton of bone and cartilage. Before that, bony creatures did not exist. The minerals in the outside world are the counter-image to the bones. The earth has preserved this period in its rock masses. Human beings have done so in bone. Man was progressively changed from a creature that was horizontal as it moved to one who went around in an erect posture. He turned that way so that his four limbs became organs for work, and only the other limbs served locomotion. The two things were connected. No creature can have capital I nature unless it has a larynx that produces sound and also walks erect. The animals did have the potential for this, but they regressed. They have, therefore, been unable to change into creatures endowed with speech, for that needs a vertical larynx. We can see this if we consider a perfectly commonplace fact. Some dogs are undoubtedly more easily taught things than parrots are. But a parrot does learn more because its larynx is vertical. Parrots and starlings learned to talk a little because they have a vertical larynx. So you see how Earth and man progressed through more and more stages of evolution. The atmosphere changed at the same time. The condition arose where the earth was merely surrounded by misty air. This was at the time when the Lemurians saw their continent scatter and migrated across to Atlantis. This made them Atlanteans. During this stage of evolution, when human beings acquired the first elements of speech, though these were mere sounds reflecting sensations they felt, the soul did also emerge more and more. Atlanteans had essentially retained a dim clairvoyance. Now, the eyes had developed to the degree to which human beings, rising up from subterranean depths of the sea, received such sunlight as penetrated the mists. They were able to see and perceive more and more. But the old clairvoyance was all the time regressing. It was only in the last third of the Atlantean era that the most advanced race of Atlanteans had evolved at one point on the Earth's surface. That was a most significant conclusion to that era. The Atlanteans, who had moved more to the west, became inwardly neutral under the conditions then prevailing, cold, indifferent. They became the copper-colored population of America. The others who migrated more to the south became the Negro population, and those who turned more to the east later became the yellow Malayan populations. These masses of people had concentrated in the most unfavorable places where one could not go any further. But in the place where Ireland is, and to the west from there, where there is ocean today, human beings had been able to evolve most. There you had those mixtures of warm and cold that allowed the human body to progress most. Willpower, still magical then, evolved into the first beginnings of an unspoken sense of I, capital. It was at this very point that human beings learned to say I to themselves for the first time. Then came the first steps in counting, reckoning, the beginnings of powers of judgment, making combinations. But there were, always, also advanced individuals among them, the guides of humanity, who related to people the way spirits from a higher realm do. They had become the teachers and guides and gave the impetus for migration to the east. Nations had moved from that point in today's Ireland all the way across to the east and to Asia. Now, the most advanced mass populations moved eastward and established some kind of colony everywhere along the way. the most powerful, with the most highly developed civilization, was in the vicinity of today's Gobi Desert. From there, individual groups later went out into all kinds of different regions in the world, some of them to present-day India. They found existing populations there, with yellowy-brown skins, and partly mingled with them. It was after the flood on Atlantis that this colony went south and established the first civilization of the post-Atlantean era, the first civilization in our era. The most advanced teachers who went with them, the first teachers of ancient India, are known as the ancient Indian Rishis. Present-day Indians are descendants of that earlier population. But to come upon the traces of their civilization, we must go a long way back, into times where darkness reigns for the study of history. The Vedas came later than this, for nothing was recorded in those times. The ancient Indian people were the first civilized group in post-Atlantean times, and they were still closest to the Atlanteans. The Atlantean was a kind of dreamer. His conscious awareness was dim, and he had no powers of judgment and self-awareness. He went about like a dreamer, half unconscious. The ancient Indians were the first to have overcome this state, but were still half caught up in it. Because of this, the ancient Indians still had their longing for experiences in the old land of spirits and for the vision that Atlanteans had had. Ancient Indian yoga training still took people back, in a state of reduced consciousness, into the time when human beings still saw the spirits around them. The Indians would long to be back in the time when people had clairvoyance on Atlantis, and in their yoga training the rishis would teach the methods, which were then, however, given a different form. The Atlanteans had not yet developed powers of judgment. In India, people did have those powers, but they loved, as it were, something which had been overcome. They knew how to evoke it again, reducing consciousness and remembering the visions of earlier times. Indian civilization had still preserved this in its greatest representatives. Indians sought not to increase conscious awareness, but reduce it to a dreamlike level. Hence the inactivity which one sees in Indians. And it would be grossly detrimental for Indian life to take up our present-day civilization to any greater degree. In the beginning, human beings had never seen minerals at all. Atlanteans would still see minerals in the vaguest possible way. The world of the spirits was there in their visions. It was this which lived in everything. They would see colors around a human being, nice colors if that individual was nice to them. That was the kind of world the Indians sought to conjure up again. But human progress means that people must develop more and more of a relationship to things in the material world. The Atlanteans had no need of tools. They took their orientation from their visionary powers. They did not consider tools important. The Indians were still trailing behind the Atlanteans. This is why the physical world was Maya to them, an illusion in a way, a lie. They were not interested in the world perceived through the senses. They would say, rise to the world of dreamlike spirituality. Progress from that Indian civilization to a later age was that in the next civilization, the Persian, which was before Zarathustra, people came to appreciate the external reality around them. This was a second colony to have come from the Gobi. A far distant realm arose in Asia Minor, and the realm of Zarathustra arose from this. The Persians came to realize that there was a world around them in which they must be active. The divine was something to them with which they must connect. two godheads existed for them, Ormuzd and Ahriman. Matter still seemed to them to be something they must overcome, something to measure themselves against. They were still taking the powers they needed to do work in this world from the world of the spirit. The world was something dark to them that had to be transformed using the light of the good. The Indians established a body of knowledge of the purely spiritual world, but this did not tell them anything about the real world they lived in. This world was something different to the Persians, something to be constantly transformed by their labors. The third colony, to come from the Gobi, moved on to Asia Minor and established the Chaldean, Babylonian, Egyptian civilization. These peoples had the earlier science of the spirit, and, now, also a body of knowledge relating to the earth world. The Egyptians developed an astrology, a geometry, by which they learned how to treat and cultivate the soil. Their knowledge extended to the sphere where the Indians still spoke of illusion. Now the world of illusion had become a world of astute reflection, reflections on things perceived through the senses. When an Indian contemplated the world of the stars, it would reflect the spiritual for him. The Chaldean, however, loved the physical world. To him it was a part of the Godhead which you worked into, focused on. And working one's way from the divine to the sense perceptible is something we also see in the Babylonian and Assyrian civilization. We now come to the fourth civilization, the one we call Greco-Roman. There, the actual human being was the subject of careful study. The Egyptians had known that the world was not chaos, but built in a meaningful way through countless eons. The Sphinx and the pyramid reflected great cosmic truths. The ancient Egyptians would magically make their knowledge part of the picture. They created the Sphinx, which stands before us like a riddle of evolution, the higher principle of human nature evolving from earlier animal-like states. That was the wisdom which the Egyptians would, in their own way, express to the world. And you find surveying skills there that have been taken from the heavens. The cities were arranged in such a way that a sacred order was reflected in the way in which they were built, an order that was prescribed. The Egyptians would seek to present a reflection of the order of the heavens. But it did not extend to individual human nature. This you find only in Greek art, where human beings were already grasping themselves in immediate reality, seeking to create their own image in three dimensions. Human beings were growing more and more familiar with the world which the Indians would call Maya. Man met himself. He created a world within the Indians' illusion, and was aware of the fact that he had to create this world without help from the gods. He connected more and more with the real world outside, using his own powers to create the divine in the real world outside. But when you study the Greek polis, city or city-state, you find nothing there that had to do with rights and laws. This had to be established in the Roman world as the law of Rome, living with others as a private Roman citizen. The fifth civilization is our own materialistic world. It is the time when man has descended deepest into the outside world. Compare our time with those that went before. We do know how to apply the powers of the spiritual world to the world outside us. We take the spiritual world into everything. But from the point of view of spiritual science, this offers a peculiar prospect. Remember the time when people still ground their flour between two stones. They used little mental power for this. But in ancient Egypt and Chaldea, they would enter deeply into the wisdom of the heavens. There, much was told of the spiritual meaning of the starry heavens and the earth itself. The Greeks created the idealized human form, making it part of this real world. What is the picture today? Much mental power is used to develop our natural science using technical applications. But how great is the difference if you use primitive means, or we use the telephone, machines, and so on, to bring foods over from America, which merely serve to satisfy a need here, which the animals also satisfy. Try to see how much of everything created serves the life of the spirit, and how much mental power is used for material life. Think of the enormous mental powers humanity has to develop today to satisfy material needs. There is no great difference between an animal going to feed on grass and us using all kinds of means to bring foods over from America and Australia. But this is not disparaging criticism, for it has to be. Human beings have had to enter so deeply into this world. The ancient Indians still saw the world as illusion. Today we see this world as the only real one. We have gone down to the greatest depth, and in doing so have made the greatest advances on the physical plane. But the descent must not be for nothing, also in the spiritual sense. A new element has come up in our time, something literally implanted into the first third of the post-Atlantean age. It is the coming of Christianity, the most significant event altogether in Earth evolution. For the occultist, everything that went before has been mere preparation for Christianity. Buddha, Hermes, and so on have been prophetic pointers to Christianity, which is to raise humanity from being most deeply caught up in matter, and it will do so. The ascent from matter is now beginning, and it is the task of spiritual science to help humanity to ascend to the world of the spirit. The next period of post-Atlantean civilization will bring even more discoveries, but human beings will increasingly see the outside world as just the letters. A genuine Christianity will speak of that world in the way in which we speak of condensed spirit, and the spirit will rise again for us from matter. We will not say that the outside world is illusion. We'll have the whole of it, and lose nothing, and yet rise to higher things in the spirit. And Christianity will make the greatest contribution to this development. In the sixth period, the things which today are made known to only a few will be able to reach vast numbers of people and take them along with them, and with this humanity will gain insight into the spiritual world. The thought of today will be a power in the future. Many will have this power of thought in the sixth period of civilization. They will be creative, influencing even the human form. The human body looked very different in the past from the way it looks today. You'd be surprised if I were to describe it to you. But the body was still soft then, and so the eye had a much greater influence on its configuration. Today only a sparse remnant remains of the influence which the soul's will once had on the body's configuration. You'll go pale if you get a shock, because your state of soul affects even the blood. The color of the body changes. Looking at other bodily states, you will see, however, that human beings have little influence on their body. This will change again in the ascent. The body will grow softer and softer, and the human being will have an influence on it again by letting his thoughts grow stronger and stronger, thoughts that do not come up very much today. They will then refashion the body itself. Human beings will be able to create their own bodies again, though this will only be in a far distant future. Gender nature was only imposed on humanity during the Lemurian age. Before that, they were hermaphrodite, both male and female. As the I came to be integrated, capital, human beings fell apart into two genders. We shall know more about that moment when we take a closer look at the progress of human blood. We will then consider this problem of division into genders and also of the future disappearance of gender division. We are thus looking toward a future when human beings will be able to influence their bodies again, but in a different way. What is going on when someone goes red from embarrassment? What does this mean? A last remnant of the influence human beings had on their body in the past. They will be able to work into their bodies more and more, deliberately so. And then a time will come when human beings will be able to make their heart muscle into a voluntary muscle. In modern science, the heart is presented as if it were a mere physical apparatus, a pump. But the blood does not just flow through the body because the heart pumps it through. Everything in the blood depends on the soul. The blood pulsates faster or more slowly under the different feelings, and it is the blood which produces the movement of the heart. But in future, human beings will gain a deliberate influence on the heart, and the heart is therefore an organ which is only at the beginning of its evolution. It is a muscle of spiritual evolution, an organ in which human beings who have advanced to a higher level will express themselves and so act creatively on the whole rest of the body. The heart is only in the beginnings of its evolution, and this makes it a problem for materialistic science. Scientists will tell you that all muscles you use to move around are cross-striated. In involuntary muscles, like those in the digestive system, the striations run lengthwise. The heart is a unique organ, for it turns it all upside down. It is an involuntary muscle, and its muscle fibers are cross-striated, for it is on the road to higher development, and therefore has cross-striated fibers even today. Tomorrow, I'm going to show you how some things become clear when we consider them in the light of occult science. Theosophy is thus spreading light on the world around us. We redeem everything which has become matter from its frozen state. That is the concept of redemption in its most profound nature. Humanity has evolved. Certain realms were always left behind in the process. Humanity will grow powerful and redeem all that has been left behind, and they will redeem the earth too. They must not despise it, however, but must connect with it in order to redeem it. The end of Lecture 11.